ESPN Daily is presented by QuickBooks. Success starts with Intuit QuickBooks.
Next bucket.
This is what I'm talking about. Look at LeBron calling for it, Rich.
And he is from Akron.
Let's do it.
Cleveland.
Let's do it in Cleveland. Cleveland.
That's a winner. Game-winning shot by LeBron James.
When LeBron drained that fadeaway Sunday to win one of the best NBA All-Star games we can remember, it wasn't just a win for him and his team and the host city of Cleveland. It was a win for a grand experiment that, on paper, once sounded absolutely insane. Because there was no buzzer for LeBron to beat in that dramatic moment. In fact, there was no clock to speak of at all. So today, we turn to Kirk Goldsberry, former vice president for strategic research with the San Antonio Spurs and current professor of sports analytics at the University of Texas, to discuss what else the NBA should seriously be rethinking in its 75th year of existence. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Friday, February 25th. This is ESPN Daily. Kirk Goldsberry, the NBA, sports in general, really loves these giant round numbers. And so this 75th anniversary thing, it occurs to me, thanks to this piece you've written for ESPN.com, that it also indicates something else that's just bluntly true, which is that the NBA at 75 is just super old now.
It's a boomer, Pablo. That's what I call it. The NBA is officially a boomer.
Yes.
Like a lot of our parents, it comes from the late 1940s, and it's starting to show its age a little bit.
Yeah, and much like texting with my dad, who I love and is also about this age, there are some questions of how comfortable the NBA really is with change and with new technologies. So what is the argument that you are here to set out, writ large?
That the NBA would be different if it started in 2022 than it is since it started in 1946. The NBA deserves a lot of credit, Pablo. It has changed and become one of the greatest leagues in the world over its 75-year history. But as its success has grown, its willingness to change has gotten a little bit more reticent because business is so good. So some of the things in the league right now, I think, deserve some reevaluation. But many of the changes that a lot of us might lobby for are just not going to fly through ownership or even the Players Association.
So we'll get to what is plausible in terms of legislation that can be passed. We'll get to what is sort of pipe dream stuff. But I'm also concerned generally, Kirk, whenever reimagining a sport occurs, especially at age 75, I'm worried of the how do you do my fellow kids sort of dynamic, right? Like showing up with a backwards cap in the skateboard, trying to blend in. But the NBA All-Star Game, Kirk, pulled this look off in a way that I think demands your explanation here. What happened in the fourth quarter of this All-Star Game? What were the rule changes that set it up to be something that actually felt like a model of a certain future?
The NBA is flirting with these targeted score endings. Sometimes it's called the Elam ending, where teams, instead of playing to a buzzer, they're playing to a target score. That score is determined at some point late in the game, where they add some preset number to the leading team's current score. So with 5 minutes left, we're going to add 15 or 10 points to the one team that's ahead score. Now that's what we're playing to.
No clock in the fourth quarter, no commercial interruption. Leading team's total after the third quarter, plus 24. The number of the great Kobe Bryant, that is the target score.
What the NBA has settled on in terms of that preset number to add to the total of the team that is up in the fourth quarter, they've chosen 24. Right? That is the number of the late, great Kobe Bryant. 24 feels like a nice round number. It has meaning. And so in this case, right, the target number ended up being first to 163, and LeBron James had that 163rd point.
LeBron out on the right. Is he trying to find Curry? No, he's going to turn. He's going to fade. And he's going to hit it for the win! The King of Cleveland returns. LeBron James winning the 71st NBA All-Star Game, 163 to 160.
When LeBron James hit that shot, his team got to that target score and the game was over. And it was very cool and it was very dramatic, and it wouldn't have been possible without a little experimentation from the league office.
Yeah, the whole Elam ending thing, Kirk, it has had a long cult following among sports nerds. It's like this evergreen crusade that you can hear in the hallways every year at the MIT Sloan Sports Analytics Conference. So how would you describe the advantage of ending a game in that way?
The Elam ending rejects that basic buzzer premise and says, no, we're playing to a score now. What that does, importantly, Pablo, is gets rid of a lot of the crap that pollutes the end of NBA games. Teams fouling on purpose.
Yes.
Teams taking awful three-point shots that they just need to either extend the game or get points in a hurry. First of all, as soon as that starts happening, the sport devolves into something that's bad. I think we would all admit that's not sportsmanlike conduct.
They're filibustering, right? They're wasting time. It is like watching C-SPAN sometimes. And these are the best athletes in the world.
I love that. They are filibustering. They're wasting time. But they're rational actors in the game that's being put forth in front of them.
Correct.
These are the right ways to play. If I can extend the game, if I'm down by four and there's 15 seconds left and I can stop the clock two, three times and maybe my opponent misses a free throw and I hit a couple of threes, we've seen games end like that. And that is the only chance to win. So they take it. The Elam ending says, if you're down by four, you need to get 4 points and you need to prevent your opponent from scoring. There's no other way to get there.
To be clear here, this is not Jason Elam, former Broncos kicker, who invented this. This is Nick Elam, a Mensa member by reputation and also just like a teacher who helped develop this idea, right?
Yeah, and there was something about watching it. It just wins you over. And I think it had its most important moment in Cleveland on Sunday with LeBron hitting that shot to win the All-Star game in his hometown.
For people who think that it is one thing to do this in an exhibition, a frivolous activity like an All-Star game, and another thing entirely to actually implement it to the actual sport itself, Kirk, there have been massive rule changes in the past too.
There's so many, Pablo. I'm going to forget some, but remember, goaltending was legal before it wasn't. The size of the lane has gone from a key shape to a big wide shape for George Mike, and then even wider for Wilt Chamberlain. And of course, in 1979, the addition of a three-point shot. That is a very drastic change to the rules, not to mention countless things like illegal defense and zone defense rules. But one of the reasons the NBA is so awesome in 2022 is because the sort of leadership of the league, from owners to players to commissioners over its 75-year history, has been willing to evolve.
You know, it's funny, Kirk, you just mentioned the birth of the three-point arc in 1979, and this is a geometric edit to the game that has obviously changed the sport as much as anything else has, right? I mean, Steph Curry, in that same All-Star game we were just talking about, hit 16 threes, but the three-point arc is not actually geometrically a true arc, right? Because at the corners along the baseline, the arc tucks in, it flattens out, and that really does make a difference.
In the NBA, for those of us who've obsessed over this line, you can picture it in your mind. It has two straight edges along the corners. The NBA three-point line can only go so far out in the corners because the baseline is 50 feet wide.
And the corners, to be very blunt about this too, Kirk, the corners being short around the three-point quote-unquote arc has been a tremendous competitive advantage for those people who seek to position themselves there.
Yeah, it's like a chessboard, and now every NBA team, if you watch contemporary basketball, has two rooks on every possession on that chessboard. P.J. Tucker is a great example.
Tucker from the corner. Oh, he loves the shot, either left or right corner.
Andrew Wiggins for the Golden State Warriors.
Jordan finding Wiggins in the sweet spot. His left corner threes are better than 50%.
A lot of times, these guys are just stationed in the corners, waiting for their defender to cheat in, and then one out of 15 possessions, Pablo, they might get a shot off from that spot, and it's a very efficient option. It's become a very key part of pro basketball strategy, but again, it stems from the fact that this court isn't wide enough. So what's happened in the last 10 years? Teams are shooting a ton of threes and abandoning the elbow jumper, the fadeaway, the hook shot that were so popular for so long. Simply put, a 24-foot jumper is a much smarter investment than a 20-foot jumper, and that's driving major changes in the best basketball league in the world.
If the NBA wanted to fix that, what solution is Kirk Goldsberry bringing to the committee?
So there are two solutions. The one is, hey, can we extend the baseline? And as I said, that 22-foot short corner is 22 feet because there's not room to go any wider. So one solution is, can we widen the width of the baseline from 50 to, say, 60 feet and then put a 25-foot arc? And everybody would have more space and the shooters would have a harder shot and the mid-range shot would creep up back into play because it would be slightly more in the conversation of efficiency. The other one that people have brought up, including myself, is eliminating that corner three area and just flagging the three-point arc out where the 23.75 part of it ends.
Mm.
So there would be no corner threes, essentially.
Cornerless basketball, Kirk. I had not thought about that one. And it feels like that one is more plausible because the trade-off of the first thing you mentioned of, hey, can we get this court a little bigger, is to kick out, I don't know, like Pete Davidson and...
But aren't those your friends? Isn't that what you know? Yeah. Who would you sit next to?
Kirk, you can't kick me out. You can't. How dare you unseat elites like myself from our preferred place of consuming basketball?
For those who don't know, Pablo Torre gets to sit by some of the best stars in Hollywood, Saturday Night Live. He's always courtside with some of the biggest stars, Ted Lasso, Pete Davidson, you name it. Pablo sat next to him at a big NBA game, folks.
I am the bottom half of a very tall person wearing a trench coat whose face is an actual celebrity. That is accurate.
Hey, so I haven't reported on this before, but after my book came out, the NBA actually approached me, Pablo, and said, hey, can you give us two proposals to look at for adjusting the three-point line? And we were getting into the process of two or three different variations that would stick with the 50-foot baseline. We can't change that, as I mentioned in this piece, but we can look at different shapes of the arc. And the first one was cornerless basketball, like you described. And the second one was keeping those corners, but then pushing that arc back to 25 feet, moving the curvy part of the arc back about 1.25 feet to make that shot harder. And that got derailed like a lot of things did in the pandemic. But again, to the league's credit, they do evaluate. They constantly tinker. And while the inertia of one of the biggest pro leagues in the world is pretty hard to change these days, they do look at it.
Well, the NBA willing to get weird enough to ask for your input, Kirk, makes me want to now just pick your brain even further, because if you have the ear of the league, I mean, let's get to even some bigger reforms that you would like to see, even like beyond the on-court stuff. Like, what is to you the most archaic aspect of the way the NBA is arranged?
Within the current constructs, we have a bunch of divisions and conferences that affect everything from who makes the All-Star game, Pablo, to the strength of schedule of different teams, to who plays in the NBA Finals. No NBA fan, if I challenged you to name the divisions in the NBA right now, could you do it?
I got the Atlantic. I think it's called the Pacific.
Yeah.
And I mean, effectively, it's the rest of them, right? Like, what are they called?
I don't know either, but I think they determine who you play and how much you play them. And in other words, they have a big influence on your eventual record because some teams are playing this asymmetric schedule and that affects everything from draft positioning to playoff seeding.
So hold on, just bookkeeping here. In the Eastern Conference, we have the Atlantic Division, the Central Division, and the Southeast Division. In the Western Conference, of course, the immortal Northwest Division, the Pacific Division, and the Southwest Division. Congratulations, of course, to the New Orleans Pelicans for somehow being in the southwestern United States. Even beyond the absurdity of Memphis, the Grizzlies, being in the Southwest too, is the fact that we will not be able to get the Phoenix Suns and the Golden State Warriors in the NBA Finals, despite the fact that at this point, they are clearly the two best teams in this sport.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate. And especially when people on our network say, this person's never even made the finals, a lot of that has to do with, well, did this person play in the East or the West? Because it's a lot easier to get out of one of those conferences, depending on which decade you're talking about.
Right.
Is Michael Jordan in your way? Or is Stephen Curry in your way? This structure really prevents us from seeing the best two teams playing for the championship, which I think is unfortunate.
Daryl Morey, the president of basketball operations of the Philadelphia 76ers. Dork Elvis, as Bill Simmons has called him, the proprietor of the Sloan Conference. A guy that we know, he keeps on proposing more stuff. And so this past week, he suggested reducing the number of regular season games down to 58. What did you make of that suggestion?
You know, Daryl is an innovator. He's a progressive thinker. With a 58-game schedule, everybody plays each other twice, home and away, and everybody has a balanced schedule. Then you could look at seeding the playoffs on a sort of universal level and getting the two best teams on opposite sides of the bracket. But this is pie in the sky stuff for a simple reason. As long as the NBA's revenue is tied directly to the number of broadcasts it can generate, this is a non-starter. Also, the players, you would think they might be into it, but no, fewer dollars for us. Hey, guess what? They're not into that either.
And of course, full disclosure here, Kirk, as ESPN employees, I do understand the trickle-down economics of this particular trade-off.
Yeah, it's a big deal. And like I said, it's a non-starter unless they can figure out a way to supplement that lost income. But Pablo, there might be a creative way to do just that.
After the break, I want to talk about exactly that.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot. Taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
So, Kirk, international soccer seems to have influenced how you think about how this game, the NBA, can be improved, made more exciting. I feel like we should start with just relegation here. And if you're an American sports fan who isn't as cosmopolitan as you, what is this? How would it keep the regular season maximally exciting?
I'm not really a soccer fan, I should say, but I have that annoying friend who always tells me why soccer is better than basketball. And
same.
He's finally gotten through to me on a couple of topics. and one of them is relegation. And he explains to me, you know, lectures to me, let's be honest, these guys are so annoying about how great soccer is.
Football.
We get it. Get out on the pitch and have a great time. But I'll say this, relegation is great because it disincentivized some of the crazy, we talked about the end game strategies. It disincentivized some of the ugly in-season strategies that currently exist in the NBA, specifically losing a lot of games on purpose. In some European soccer leagues, they take the lower placed teams in their tables and remove them from the upper division and put them in a lower division and replace them with the teams that have performed very well in the lower division. And that's a really cool idea. And if pro basketball had it, teams like the Magic or the Pistons or the Thunder this year would not be behaving the way they're behaving. Teams like the Process Era 76ers that I know you followed very closely would not have existed because they would have become G League franchises. So the construct of the NBA without relegation and with a draft system that gives some of its most prized resources, those top draft picks, to its worst performing teams, is actually incentivizing teams to lose games. So I think relegation, if it were to happen, would help fix that issue, Pablo.
I love the idea. I mean, look, for all my affection for the process era Sixers, I have always understood that the system they took advantage of, were incentivized to take advantage of, was ridiculous. The idea that losing gets you the most important resource, as you put it, a future NBA superstar, which would have more impact in basketball, given that it's a five-person game, starting lineup-wise, than any other sport imaginable, is all insane. And now you're saying that we could actually envision a world where the Detroit Pistons are like, well, not geographically sent to Fort Wayne, but sent out of the league entirely, kicked out of the house that is top-level NBA.
Yeah, we can envision it, but it's also not going to happen. Again, because the league has 75 years of baggage / tradition, there is no way that an owner of the Sacramento Kings or of the Detroit Pistons is going
to
sign
up. To pick two teams at random. Yeah.
They're going to say, hey, you know what? I'm cool with becoming a G League team. We don't deserve it. That's obviously not going to happen.
Right. And it does feel like if you're an NBA owner who doesn't have to opt in to the risk of being humiliated and then financially destroyed, you probably don't want to do that for, quote unquote, the greater good of this entertainment product.
It's a pipe dream, but sometimes pipe dreams are fun to think about.
But let's keep dreaming about them then, because
all right.
Adam Silver has been talking for years, Kirk, about an in-season tournament, right? And this is another soccer concept, another global football concept.
The notion is, you know, I've said this before, trying to steal a page, particularly from European soccer, where they have other trophies that they play for and begin a new tradition of something that players care about, teams care about, something to win.
So what does an in-season tournament sound like to you? What would the point of it be?
The point of it to me is entertainment. And the NBA is one of the most entertaining products in the world of sports. And an in-season tournament breathes some life into the middle of the season. If you're an NBA fan, you start in October and you go through June. What if there was something in January or February that brought the word championship into that part of the calendar year? That would be awesome. And again, European soccer has done it. For the fans, Pablo, it gives more relevance. It gives you a chance to win a second championship in a year.
How do you make that championship feel like a championship if it's a mid-season thing that is sort of this new kind of innovation as opposed to an established cultural thing we revere?
You know, there will be people who think it's some sort of arbitrary construct that doesn't deserve our attention. That's going to happen. But so are pro sports. And, you know, all of this is make-believe. The Super Bowl didn't exist until it
How
did.
How dare you?
The NFL versus AFL was a dream. And who cares? These two divisions, who cares who wins that?
And also the Super Bowl is kind of a terrible name. Like, it seems very fake.
Regardless, I think, again, we can learn from other leagues around the world. These mid-season tournaments in European soccer draw passionate fans to their television sets and to the ticket office for a reason. It's fun. Single elimination basketball is something that largely, with the exception of the play-in tournament now, has been missing from the NBA.
Absolutely. No, and the play-in tournament, as you say, which was implemented last year, has been a successful experiment in that single elimination, winner go home kind of a fashion. But Kirk, to just pick up the thread from what we talked about earlier, it does feel like there is a revenue generation aspect to this idea that would potentially balance out a shortened regular season to you? Is that how you see it?
I think all the players and coaches and even some of the owners will admit 82 games is too many in terms of figuring out which teams deserve to go to the postseason, in terms of keeping our athletes in great shape and in great condition for the postseason. A lot of us have concluded 82 games is a little bit too many. That said, it's a non-starter shortening to Maury's 58-game schedule unless we can supplement that lost revenue. The mid-season tournament could be just the pathway to inject more cash, inject more revenue, and help us reduce the number of regular season games from 82. I don't know if it gets us all the way to 58, but that would be the key. Would this tournament generate enough money for the league, the teams, and the players to get us to a shorter regular season?
Kirk, after the break, We at ESPN Daily have many ideas that we want to run by you.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky. 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home some huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
So, Kirk, you established earlier, you reported exclusively earlier that the NBA has asked for your advice in the past as to how to reimagine this game. And we here at ESPN Daily are here, if nothing else, to self-promote and take advantage of your platform. So I have some ideas. We have some ideas. And the first one, we're going to come out hot. No more quarters. Quarters are stupid. We want 5 10-minute sessions of play. Play best of five in those five sessions. And in theory, Kirk, what this would do, and I feel like now I'm on Shark Tank, but what it would do is make every single session as valuable as the next, whereas now, obviously, the first quarter kind of seems low stakes compared to the fourth when the engines really start revving. What do you think about that?
I like it for some reasons. For instance, it's one of the classic NBA takedowns from a casual fan is like, give each team 94 points and put 2 minutes on the clock, which implies the first 46 minutes are irrelevant. And so some casual fans are turned off by that exact fact, right? Like the first quarter doesn't really matter. And so what you're proposing is, hey, to make this sort of a five-game series, that is more like tennis or volleyball. Hey, there's precedence there, right, for these sets.
Yes.
I'm not mad at it. As an analyst, I would say the blowback is going to come from our ability to compare past eras to the current era. And that's a big thing to consider for a lot of us.
But I actually just want to fully incinerate all of the record books now, Kirk, because this next idea, I want to get even weirder with it. No more free throw line.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, this is something that I don't think is actually so radical when you boil it down, because the idea here, of course, is that a player draws a shooting foul, but they just take their one shot, in this case, from the spot where they were fouled. No defender in front of them. And if you make the thing, it's just worth the value of the original shot, wherever it may have been.
This court is a rule change that I've heard brought up before. And I love this one. I think it disincentivizes a couple of things that are really sort of hurting the league right now, which is wrapping up an athlete who's about to go make a beautiful slam dunk, a highlight play. Hey, who wants to see Ja Morant dunk it? Not me. I'd rather him go shoot 2 15-foot shots from the middle of the court and take a 1 minute break from this action. But you can't fault the defenders. Wrapping up Ja Morant in that exact instance and sending him 15 feet away magically is a great play. If instead Ja could just dunk it from the place you fouled him and you would still get the personal foul, I think we would arrive at a better place. So this one, I think, is kind of crazy when you first think about it, but makes a lot of sense. And one more point. It disincentivizes Trae Young from trying to draw these crazy shooting fouls 35 feet from the basket.
Yes.
Okay, Trae, now make your 35-footer. That's another imp. So I like this one, Pablo.
And so this is where I am now emboldened to bring in all of this like technological innovation too, Kirk. Because, I mean, you know this stuff as well as anybody. We have all of this data about where exactly these shots are being taken, how much they're all worth. And I guess what we here at ESPN Daily are wondering is, why are we still prisoners to the totalitarian regime of whole numbers? Right? Like, why is a layup not worth 1 point? It's so close to the basket. Why isn't a half-court shot worth like 5? Why isn't a shot at the corner worth less than 3 if it's not actually fully the same distance as another three-pointer? Why isn't a Steph Curry 3 from the logo worth, I don't know, 4.3 points? Why can't we go decimals to even make it more precise, Kirk? How does this idea strike you?
It strikes me as fanciful, but it's a cool way to think about one of the big issues that the league is facing, which is some of these shots aren't as hard as you're giving me the reward for, and some of them are really hard, and you're not giving me the reward. Dirk Nowitzki's 17-foot fadeaway over Kevin Durant or Tim Duncan is one of the hardest shots that any NBA player has ever made.
Nowitzki, guarded by Duncan. Gets it a go.
Are you kidding me? That was so well defended.
And it's worth 2 points.
Right.
And it's only going to go in 40% of the time. We're disincentivizing him to do that because his teammate Jason Terry shooting a corner three is a much more efficient option. The big issue with the analytics era, as we've said, is it exposed these efficiency differences in different places. And what you're getting at is correcting that with a better, more precise accounting. I don't think we're ever going to see fractions or decimals on scoreboards, but I do love the idea of reevaluating. In fact, Kiki Vandeweghe has proposed to me, hey, we should make the dunk worth 3 points because we want more dunks. And the players that do that should be elevated to a more valuable status. And the players that don't do that, you know, they're not selling as many tickets, let's be honest. So I think tweaking these is possible, but I'm not going to let you bring decimals onto my scoreboard.
Yeah, I feel like Bob Ryan somewhere just woke up in a cold sweat, just furious at both of us. And I guess the last thing here I have to ask you, Kirk, before we let you go is, are you a Harry Potter guy? You're familiar with the Harry Potter cinematic universe?
Yeah, we're reading them at my house right now. We're on book number 5, Pablo.
So can we get something that would diffuse the whole like blowout probability, right? Like the idea that even an Elam ending can't solve for a blowout. How can we fix this? How can we get something that's equivalent to like a golden snitch, Kirk, where if you retrieved it, it is worth like an insane amount of points and you win the game based on that? Can we make a real life golden snitch is my question.
Yeah, I think we could. And let's entertain it for a second. So if a team is down by 20 points in the fourth quarter, usually most of us turn the game off. And those of us who work for teams would say, hey, this team deserves the win here. But we'll put that away. let's get this game back to being competitive. I think you could do something like a power play for a team that's behind a 5-on-4 for a few minutes. I think you could add a 4-point shot if you were really interested in for one team. But, you know, when the Warriors play the Kings, they're supposed to blow them out. That's good. That's what we want to see. I know it's not great on a night-to-night basis to see one, but it helps demonstrate that, hey, the Warriors are better at this than the Kings. And I think, why do you want to take that out?
What you're saying is that you have the philosophy that like David Attenborough has when he's filming a gory nature documentary. He's like, I'm not here to interfere with the way the food chain has been designed.
I'll go the
by
other
God.
Way. In the spirit of the nature documentary, let's humiliate the blowout team. Let's just end the game. Let's add a mercy rule. You're sending your fans home early because you're down 20. And as soon as you're down 20, the game ends. And now the people of the Sacramento or the people of Detroit have to file out. They just sat down 30 minutes ago, and now they're down 25-5, and it's over.
Kirk Goldsberry, thank you for being so futuristic with us that you wound up sounding like my 75-year-old immigrant father.
Hey, sounds like a cool guy.
Yeah, he is. And like me, he is named Pablo Torre. And this has been ESPN Daily. Our show is produced by Bradford Craig, Alexander Hyacinth, Mike Johns, Ryan Nantel, Mike Philbrick, Andy Tennant, Eve Tro, Chris Tuminello, and Aaron Vale. Special thanks this week to Andre Soto, Christian Gardner, Abu Kamara, and Jackson Ogilo. I'll talk to you Monday.